today. Today is March 27th.
This is April.
Oh, I'm sorry. It's April 27, 2005. Let's have the House Committee on Trade and Economic Development will come to order. First agenda we have, we are going to have a public hearing on 3350.
We'll do a work session, I
think. We will have a...
You've had a public hearing on this one.
Okay, we will,
Mr. Chairman. I would suggest.
I will open a work session on the House Bill 3143.
You want to open on 3350.
And also the 3350. All right.
Mr. Chair, House Bill 3350, you heard on the 11th of April, it expands the eligibility for counties to participate in the business development tax incentive certifications. It has a number of details in it. You have the dash one from Representative Butler, which removes the minimum annual employee compensation requirements. You may recall that testimony was that there has not been the participation in the program, and that was one of the main stumbling blocks. That's the dash one removes that minimum annual employee compensation requirement. You have the dash two, which talks about designations of areas in rural as rural renewable energy development zones. You had a little bit of discussion on that when you met before. The dash threes simply combine the dash one with the dash two.
Where's dash three?
I don't have
it. It's in the package.
It's in the package.
Here's a copy. All right. I'd like to invite Representative Butler. Since you are there, you should know more about it, and please give us some insight.
Thank you, Chairman, members of the
committee. It's an honor to be with you. My name is Tom Butler. I'm from House District 60. Like others of our legislative assembly, many of the areas in the state of Oregon have suffered through some rather high unemployment during the last number of years. Particularly rural Oregon seems to suffer inordinately with regard to the high percentages of unemployment. One of the counties that I have the blessing and opportunity and privilege, rewarding privilege to represent, had as much as 30+% of unemployment during this past 5 years with changes in the economy and changes in our natural resources industries. As a result of that, we've also suffered from high loss of the higher paying jobs, and so our median income has continued to drop down. And so what I bring today in the Dash 1 amendment is an opportunity to the bill open up for a sunsetted period of, I believe it's 5 years, Mr. Chair, to open up for 5 years the opportunity for new-to-Oregon businesses to come to a rural and distressed community, setting up their shop and hiring five or more employees. And the Dash 1 amendment says that it recognizes, again, this is an amendment to the overall small community investment program, but it recognizes that minimum wages, since the time that the small community investment program was developed years ago, that the minimum wage has approached the median wage in many of these particular counties. And so the concern is that if we can remove the high wage requirement under the small community investment program, we can get some $15,000 and $20,000 a year jobs in these communities, and recognize that $15,000 is about a minimum wage job, and that's very close. One of the counties that's involved here has a $17,000 median income. That means that That means that I've got a lot of people earning below $15,000 a year in these wages. So what the Dash 1 amendment does is it opens up the program on 3350 to say let's expand the numbers of counties that we could go into and bring new businesses to Oregon. I recognize that it's probably wildly unpopular to think that anybody is going to come to Fossil, Oregon with 500 new jobs. However, I do believe that they might come to Fossil, Oregon with 5 new jobs and pay them a family wage of $15,000 or some such amount. So the Dash 1 amendment removes the high income requirement, the high compensation requirement, and does so in this bill that I am proposing, that we expand the limitations of the Small Community Investment Program for up to 5 years. I did this after consultation with the OECD. My contact in the Economic Development Department, I asked him to come forward and help me and basically tell me if my baby was ugly here, and he did. He said, I've got to shoot your dog in front of you. The problem with trying to bring these jobs to rural Oregon is that the wage base that you've got, that the law provides for, is far more than you could ever attract. And so after having that conversation, I had prepared the Dash 1 amendment to make the wage base, whatever the willing buyer and the willing seller and the wage marketplace recognize, that whatever they can agree at, recognize please also that the amounts that we're talking about, excuse me, about six of you sitting in each place right now. the wage base that we're talking about are wages in communities that have high unemployment. So I've got people that are willing to work for lesser wages than perhaps they would if they were in a high employment market. But I also have a concern that these folks need jobs, and to the extent that we can provide them jobs, then I believe that we will be able to provide a way to provide an opportunity for these people not to come to the state to ask for a handout, but to just say, can we try to create our own jobs within our communities and then lift ourselves up. Again, I've had two concerns expressed from our colleagues in the House and the Senate. Number one is that this bill could be used to attract new to Oregon businesses that might bring their own employees, that might have some particular profession, that a printing or a dye business or something of that nature, a molding business, that might come to Oregon and bring their own employees, some people that already have those professional skills. And I say if they want to bring 5 new full-time employees to Oregon and bring those professionals, then maybe they'll fill up our schools. They'll be paying Oregon income tax where we didn't have it before. And also they might hire a receptionist and they might hire a custodian in these communities. Under the current Small Community Investment Program, they have to invest in property, plant, and equipment. They have to be members of the community that pay their property taxes, that have full-time employees, that have invested in the community. They cannot unfairly compete with any other businesses in the community. What this bill does is it says, let's open up the numbers of communities and the rural and distressed communities of the state and those counties which are rural and distressed. And number two, let's remove, and the Dash 1 amendments, let's remove that high income requirement that the folks have to be earning to qualify.
Okay. Any questions? Representative Bradley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Butler, you mentioned there were two things that people had problems with, and you told us one of them.
Chair Lemon, Representative Riley, you're absolutely right. When I started seeing everybody there, I thought maybe everyone's going to start asking more questions. The other concern was that this might create a Nike coming to Adrian, Oregon. That perhaps someone could bowl over a small community by trying to bring a 500 person plant to a very small community. And while I would love to have a 500 job community outreach program to be able to bring a Nike or an assembly. And I think the assembly question was, what would happen if an assembly job, which we presently are subbing out to out of state, were to decide, hey, we want that in Oregon so that we can earn that profit with Oregon employees and have the net income for up to 10 years for the qualifying new plant that we would make in Oregon, we would want that to be income tax free, which the Small Community Investment Program provides. The truth of the matter is that in these small communities, unless you had a really significant labor force very close at hand, there's no way that you're going to get more than a half a dozen or a dozen employees. So the concern was that we might change the community blend and the community mix. And I think we overcame that in the 2001 session and 2003 session. The community mix should still be the same if, in fact, we had, and incidentally, by opening up the doors to try and bring people into the low-income, high-unemployment counties, if we were to bring a company to Cook County where maybe they could attract some folks to come down and work at a computer chip industry in Prineville, and could hire up to 200 family wage jobs, then I think that the Burn or the Bend Redmond area would certainly be able to absorb that and provide those employees. But then I've got to believe that some of those 200 employees would be local and some would move in, and my Cook County schools would be benefited. So the second issue was, will you change the blend of a community? And I, to this point, we haven't been able to attract anyone to the state of Oregon under our Small Community Investment Program. We've tweaked it enough times to make sure that they're going to stay within the UGB and use the city services. Those are the requirements that they have to have. But we've also added the port districts to it, too, to try and say if a port is located between this large city and this large city, and it's in one of those counties with a high unemployment, low per capita income, but then they might be able to attract 20 jobs into a port, a new port activity in one of those counties.
All right. Representative Buckley.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Butler, if I can just go over these points with you and have you confirm that these are the elements of the bill as I understand them. This would be voluntary for the counties to participate in. They would feature businesses that are new to Oregon that would not compete with existing businesses. The minimum wage law would still be respected in all respects, and there is a sunset after 5 years. Am I correct on those points, sir?
Chair Lim, Representative Buckley, you're absolutely correct. The voluntary nature of the program was to accomplish the second issue that you had, that you've mentioned, and that is the unfair competition. We wanted to have, because the aggregate of communities, both with regard to median income and with regard to unemployment, is county by county. And because the businesses have to set up in a city's limits or within a city UGB, we have the issue that both the city and the county can sign off in order to bring these businesses. Businesses make applications through the Department of Economic Development. And then the Department of Economic Development determines that they are new to the state, that they are new, it's a new business that's occurring, and that they're not just shifting around in the state. But then they also determine that there isn't a business like that they'd be competing with and taking employees away from another established business necessarily in the community. And that was kind of an anti-churn issue. And finally, with regard to the minimum wage, you're absolutely correct. There's no attempt to evade or avoid the minimum wage here. We've seen the minimum wage in these communities come up to where it's the living wage, and so these businesses, it's anticipated, would all pay at least the minimum wage. We hope that through a sunset of 5 years, we'll be able to attract 20 or 30 new businesses into these communities, which will change the blend of our, well, it changed the nature of our declining school enrollment, and would then give us an opportunity to bring some actual property back onto the tax rolls in the terms of long-term investments in property, plant, and equipment. So, and if the program isn't wildly successful in 2 years, Representative Buckley, I hope to come back and try one more shot at it, to tweak it one more time, so that we can figure out a way. It's to all communities' interests that rural Oregon remain viable. And this was a way to not say, hey, we're going to go take your property tax, because that's what we do in enterprise zones right now. As we go in, we say, if you forfeit or rebate the property taxes in these enterprise zones, then we'll let you go ahead and see if you can attract these new businesses. This is a way where these folks don't have to be in an enterprise zone. But basically what happens is, by bringing these businesses new to Oregon, one of these communities, then we see an opportunity for the state to contribute. That is, the forfeited income tax that we would have collected had that business located in Beaverton or in Hillsborough, if they're willing to come to Monument or to Adrian, then what happens is that the state will say, because it's new to Oregon, we'll go ahead, and because you're employing five or more full-time employees, then we'll go ahead and forfeit the income tax that you would have enjoyed, that you would have had to pay on your net profits. Now, I'm going to share a secret with you, Representative Buckley, that this can't go outside this room. We don't pass any secret legislation, but we'll... That is that most businesses, in my business experience, most businesses, most small businesses of these natures, do not enjoy a great profit during the first 4 or 5 years anyway. And so when we say, we're not going to tax you on your losses, we wouldn't have done that anyway.
Right.
And so, if you will, I'm either trying to attract new to Oregon businesses that may be doing business in the state of Idaho or the state of Washington or the state of California or Nevada, and doing so profitably, and they've found the better mousetrap. They've figured out the way to make the money, and they don't like to pay the B&O tax in Washington or the high income tax in California. And maybe they'll come here, and maybe they'll set up. And you know what? We'd probably then have truly forfeited some income tax. So in that regard, this is the state's contribution to the economic development enterprise and economic zones, the development zones that we're trying to establish, and foregoing some income tax.
Thank you. Just one comment.
One more question.
Yeah. I just wanted to say thank you so much for the effort that you put into this, try to see it from every single side and try to create jobs for your communities. I respect that highly.
Thank you, Representative.
All right, any other questions? Okay. When this idea of this bill has been effective, about 4 years ago, 2001?
Mr. Chair, you're exactly right. It passed into law in 2001. I've been working on it longer than that. It took me a long time to convince Governor Kitzhaber that a business in California wasn't paying any Oregon income tax. If we could bring them here and have them an opportunity to pay some Oregon income tax, that really wouldn't have cost us anything if they were going to invest in a community and then hire some of our unemployed.
Okay.
The genesis goes longer than 2001. The first bill passed in 2001. We modified it to add the ports and to extend out to the urban growth boundaries. We had a business actually lined up in Lake County. But I didn't realize that Lake County's urban growth boundary, all their industrial sites are in the urban growth boundary. They use all of the city services, and that's what we wanted, what we were attempting to try to do, but it was not in the city limits. So what we did was we modified it in such a way as to include UGBs, and we also modified it so as to add the additional ports to the overall protocol.
Okay, so with these changes, there's 1, 2, combined, there's 3. Do you believe this will work?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I am responsible for the Dash 1 amendments, the Dash 2 amendments, and the Dash 3 combining 1 and 2 are the responsibility of others. I have no objection to the cities bringing forward, the cities and counties bringing forward the issues with regard to renewable energy zones as a portion part of this bill.
All right. If there's no further questions, and I'd like to call at this time.
Thank you, Representative.
Mike McArthur from the AOC, and why don't you also listen to the same?
If you want to know what the information about that, you know about, right? I'll just check with him.
Okay. Hi, Mike. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thanks to the committee. I'm Mike McArthur, the Director of the Association of Marin Counties. I'm here on behalf of the bill you've just discussed with Chair Butler and the amendments, and I would like to speak to both the base bill and the amendments. I think we could call this the Omnibus Rural Development Bill for this session. We have worked with Chair Butler's bill for the last 4 years, as I was formerly the county judge in Sherman County, which was one of the counties that initially qualified for this incentive and still remains qualified for the incentive. We put together a packet, and I had a handbill here that during your first hearing that I passed out. We were offering incentives. This community in income tax incentive, we fondly refer to it as the Butler Bill. We put together a package of incentives that included the income tax that this bill, income tax savings this bill provides, possibility of an enterprise zone, so no income tax to the business, no property tax to the business. Obviously, we have no sales tax or county development charges in Sherman County. Plus, we had a farmer willing to give away land, if you recall that in the article in the Oregonian last year, just outside the city of Wasco, to a business that provided family wage jobs. We had no takers. We had tire kickers come around. We had all kinds of scam artists. We had no real business. All those incentives and no real business was willing to locate on Highway 97 in north central Oregon, 120 miles from Portland. So what we're saying is we need to enhance this incentive that, as Mr. Butler has proposed, even with that, there's no guarantees. But the idea that more people might move to town is a good thing. Yeah. In a county like Sherman, we have a high school that could serve 300 students. It has about 110. We have the infrastructure, the road system, the sewer and water system, the land available for more residents. The economy scale there just isn't sufficient to support the kind of community services that you'd really like to see. So we're very much in support of the changes Mr. Butler's, Representative Butler's proposing in the base bill, and hope that you'll move that bill out. Now, Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to answer questions about the economic or the income tax incentive. Then we can go on to the other part if you'd like.
Yeah. All right. Questions?
One quick question. Please.
Okay. Representative Buckley.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mike, the counties that qualify, the top half of county unemployment rates and the bottom half of county per capita income, is there a list of those counties? Have those been provided to us?
Mr. Chair, Representative Buckley, the last time I looked, there were four. And this was initially during the first biennium. This past it was Sherman, Cook, Lake, and Morrow. I'm not sure, Mr. Chair, Representative Buckley, I'm not sure of the current status. Perhaps. Thank you,
Vice Chair.
Now I'm sure. Mr. Chair, I have the list. Counties that meet both criteria are Baker, Coos, Crook, Kearney, Josephine, Klamath, Lake, Lynn, Malheur, Morrow, Sherman, Umatilla, Wasco.
Thank you very much.
Mike, I didn't hear, pardon me,
yes.
Mr. Chair. I didn't hear Grant County, and they have the highest unemployment in the state, and I didn't hear that.
It's not on this list, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Yes.
A comment that I think is almost redundant. We have, in those counties, unemployment rate that is so stubborn, and we heard testimony from economic development people that we must get technology and manufacturing going, and that it's like a stoplight and cars moving through a stoplight. In those counties, this is the best opportunity that anybody can come up with. And I say that it is no guarantee that we will move those unemployment rates or bring people into town, but I almost feel as we have a moral obligation to give this a shot. Thank you.
All right, and thank you very much. And you like
to, Mr. Chair, if I could continue, I'd like to speak to the other amendments, the dash two and now dash three amendments. I think is the operational amendments we're seeking today. We appreciate Chair Butler's allowing us to add another issue to his bill, which also addresses rural economic development. During the last session, we tried to develop a new type of enterprise zone called the Rural Renewable Energy Development Zone, or Red Zone as it's fondly referred to. That was to address the circumstance where wind farms, in particular, were locating in rural Oregon, and the idea that wind farms initially needed an incentive to locate here. We needed to be competitive against Washington and Idaho to locate some of these. It's a great type of economic development in a sense, in that it brings great value to your property tax base eventually, but it's a very competitive marginal business right now. And so there was an interest in providing the enterprise zones on some part of some counties. And what we said was in the original bill that the first $100 million would be exempt from property taxes if the county chose to allow the extension of the enterprise zone. And what you do if the enterprise zone, typically you've got it near an urban growth boundary because you've got the services that are necessary. And for a renewable energy, you don't need those services. And they're also located a long ways from town. So what you have to do is extend your enterprise zone to that area and then have the footprints of the towers. So what we said with the renewable energy zone was that the whole county would essentially be a zone, and you wouldn't have to do this mapping of the footprint. What the difficulty was is this $100 million limit. To give an example of how that played out, currently Klondike Phase 2 is under construction in Sherman County. It's about a $60 million investment by Pacific Power Marketing. The county was interested in working with Pacific Power Marketing to help them, incentivize them to locate in Sherman County this project. And so they were in agreement that they would give an enterprise zone, but the problem is that once Sherman County granted the renewable enterprise zone, created this zone, then PPM could come in and do the $60 million, the county had nothing to say about the next $40 million. Someone else could come in, and they would be automatically qualified to do a development, and the county would have nothing to say about their property tax dollars already in place. So what we're saying here is that, and this was the original intent of the bill 2 years ago, is it's up to whatever the county specifies in its resolution. And if the county doesn't specify anything in its resolution, then it's $100 million. It's a fairly simple change. And we've worked with the Department of Economic Development about the technical language that the Dash 3s give you to allow that to happen.
Okay. Representative Dallam has a question.
Yes, Mike, I'd like to clarify that when you build a wind-generating tower, I'm going to use the term sweet spot, you build it where the wind blows, and it's very scientifically calculated where that will be the best. So we have to move our enterprise zone to match the wind. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Dallam, that is correct.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Okay. Okay. That's all right. Representative Buckley.
Mike, thank you. Is there a sunset on the energy enterprise zone that you're referring to?
Mr. Chair, Representative Buckley, no. Not in this amendment. Mr. Chair, Representative Buckley, to clarify, There are a couple of different types of enterprise zones. The most typically, there are three-year abatements for these type of projects. Because for longer abatements, there needs to be a stronger job creation component, which these don't typically have. And I don't think the only two counties that have given enterprise zones to Sherman and Gillum, and in each case, those were three-year zones.
So, one follow-up?
Follow-up.
So the county has the ability then to designate the length of the enterprise zone contract, or is there...
If an enterprise zone is created, it's a minimum of 3 years. There's an option for an additional 2 years.
Thank you.
So there is a limitation.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Okay. Thank you very much.
Sure.
And I have one more person to testify. Where is the name of it?
This is from the last. This is from the hearing. This is not from today. This week it arrives here.
Oh, okay. This is the last?
Well, Mr. Hickman is here. He could talk more about the renewable energy aspect of the dash 2 and the dash 3.
Okay. May I invite Brett Hickman, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee have been drafted.
Thank you. And could you give us some light on the... what was that one? Wind.
The energy aspects. Of
energy aspect of this bill.
Yeah. Right. Just Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Brad Higby on behalf of the Renewable Northwest Project, a interest group that promotes the development of renewable energy in the Northwest. And as I mentioned at the last hearing on this bill, we are very supportive of the Dash 2 and the Dash 3 amendments. Essentially, we worked closely with the counties last session to try to come up with a flexible tool that would actually work to induce counties to be interested in doing what they could to lure wind development. Not only creates new energy, promotes clean energy, provides additional diversity to our region's energy supply, but it also creates a measure of economic input, a shot in the arm, if you will, with construction jobs, ongoing maintenance jobs. And as importantly, provides lease payments, so an additional shot of revenue to the farmers and ranchers who would have the wind turbines on their property through annual lease payments. And ultimately, it will result in a substantial increase in the amount of property tax revenue that a county would collect, as former Judge MacArthur testified to. So to that extent, it seemed to us to be a fairly logical new beast, if you will, and it didn't require artificially stretching and elongating existing enterprise zones. It just made sense to us, as Representative Dalman indicated, to provide a mechanism so that the wind development could be built where the wind blows. That's in a nutshell, if that is in fact a nutshell, is why we think the original program, as modified by these amendments, would be good for the development of renewable energy in the Northwest.
Any questions? Okay. No questions?
No.
Okay. Do you know any companies applying for to come to this rural area for the renewable energy, such as wind power?
Well, Mr. Chair, there are a number of developments that I believe are either in line or on the drawing board. I know that the one that Judge MacArthur made reference to was actually going to be the first one to take advantage of this red zone a year or so ago. But because of the interpretation of the statutory language, they were not able to use this particular new, hopefully, flexible program. Instead, I believe Judge MacArthur was able to work through an existing enterprise zone and draw one of those weird gerrymandering type lines out to include this project. Whether or not there are additional projects in his former county or other counties out there, I'm not exactly sure. But I just want to reiterate, if I could, Mr. Chair, that this is entirely voluntary. No county is forced to do this. If they wish to do this, they then, by resolution, adopt this program and submit it to the department for approval. And ultimately, and I think Judge MacArthur is probably better at describing how this would work to you all, it's true, it would provide up to 3 years or maybe as many as 5 years property tax abatement for the value of these wind turbines. But the developer, especially if the county is holding the control of this particular program, the developer would have to sit down with the county and work out some sort of mitigation plan. So there is, in essence, some bargaining ability for the county from the very outset.
Okay. What are the status of our state compared to the Washington and California in terms of renewable energy resources such as wind power? Are we ahead or behind or even par?
Well, Mr. Chair, again, going back to the point that was made previously, it really is a function of where the wind is blowing. Montana and Wyoming, for example, have some of the windiest areas in the entire country. I think if somebody, if I'm remembering correctly, somebody mentioned to me about 4 years ago that if all the potential wind capacity was developed in the state of Montana, I think it would, I hope I'm not making this up now, but it would provide enough energy to supply virtually the entire western part of the United States. Oregon has some very good spots, not nearly as many as the state of Montana. Similarly, Washington has got some fairly windy areas that could be developed in the future. Washington is moving ahead with a number of projects, but Oregon is doing fairly well as well. California got an early start, and probably, I don't want to really call them a guinea pig of sorts, but since a lot of their projects were initiated 20, 25 years ago, they provided a benefit to everybody else because they've shown us how not to do things, meaning the Altamont project, some of the errors in how those particular turbine systems were developed and built, so that the newer designs take into account everything we've learned so far in terms of protecting avian resources, generating the most amount of energy per turbine as possible without cluttering the landscape with overly many. Without dancing too much around your question, Mr. Chair, I think we're right there in a position to compete relatively aggressively with the other states in the West and, to the extent possible, maximizing the available resources. Tools like this, flexible tools like this that a county can voluntarily embrace will certainly help.
Okay. All right. And one more question I have. What are the spots in our state likely to take advantage of this bill, especially renewable energy such as power?
Well, Mr. Chair, as I dimly recall from having long ago looked at the statute, it's defined so that it only applies to rural counties, so it'll be applying to some of the ones on a list that people behind me probably have as well. I'm not currently aware of some of the projects that are teetering on the edge of being green-lighted that would likely move forward if there was a program like this in place. But it would seem to me, Mr. Chair, that many of the counties in central and north central Oregon would be in a position to work with and accommodate potentially some wind developers in moving forward on this. Right. That, Mr. Chair, those seem to be the windier areas in the state. There are a few others that might justify the investment, but it really is a function of determining what the wind resources are in a particular area.
All right, any questions? If not, okay. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
So currently we have the 3350 and then a -1-2 amendment, and the -3 is the one and combined both of it together. Am I correct?
That's correct.
So that the... do we have a motion to move -3?
Could I make that motion? That we move the -3 amendment?
Yes, Dallum, yeah. Have you moved the motion already?
Yes.
Okay, Representative Dallum moved to adopt the -3 amendment to the House Bill 3350. If there's no objection, okay, then it's adopted. And this is referred to the ways in the to the revenue committee.
That's correct.
Okay, and so I'm ready to move this bill to the.
Go for it.
Mr. Chairman, I move House Bill 3350 to the revenue committee as amended.
As amended. Okay. Representative Dallum moves yes. That the House Bill 3350.
It's okay. We need to amend.
What did you say?
Well, I think you need to specify whether you want to do pass or not.
You
could
pass
with a do pass recommendation.
Okay.
Thank you, Jim.
Thank you. Move to pass this bill to the 3350 with the amendment to the Ways and to the Revenue Committee. Okay, and any discussions?
Just one comment to make, Mr. Chair, if I may. Not only wind and the traditional turbine design, I've been recently reading about experiments in Australia where they're building towers that take advantage of heat. And the tower is large enough that it, as hot air rises from a desert floor, it turns turbines and sends energy back down. And hopefully that will be something that we'll be able to have in Central Eastern Oregon as well.
Okay. In the Australia, did you say?
In Australia.
Well, I think that's the one we need to think about it.
Yeah.
All right. And any other comment? If not, I'd call the roll.
Representative Bruin.
Aye.
Representative Buckley.
Aye.
Representative Down.
Aye.
Representative Merkley.
Aye.
Representative Nelson.
Excused.
Representative Riley.
Aye.
Chair Lynn.
Aye. And House Bill 3350 with amendment that passed and referred to the Revenue Committee. And then so do I need to open up work session again on another one?
Close this one.
Yes. Okay. I'd like to close the work session on the House Bill 3350. And then
we already have one open. The 3150.
Which one we should do first? How about the 3144? What's that?
I think you have to do 3143 unless you want to wait another 5 minutes because we posted 3144. 47 hours and 55 minutes ago.
Okay.
So because of an annoying
so
vice chair.
5 minutes.
I would go ahead with House Bill 3143.
Right now? Because of the timeline?
Yes.
Okay. I'd like to open, this is a work session, right? Work session, House Bill 3343.
House Bill 3143, Mr. Chair. I apologize that I failed to get amendments to everyone ahead of time. You have the dash 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5, so quite a few amendments on this. The original bill eliminates limitation on the number of enterprise zones that may be designated, eliminates economic hardship requirements, and eliminates the 10-year limitation on enterprise zone designation. The dash 1, which you had previously, does some additional changes to the basic bill. The dash 2 amendment and the dash 3 amendment are similar. They keep all of the basic provisions of enterprise zones. They merely change the number of possible designations. The dash 2 amendment adds 10 enterprise zones that would be possible. The dash 3 adds 15 new zones. You have, in addition, two amendments, the dash 4 and the dash 5. The dash 4 is an opt-out provision for special districts, and the dash 5 is the same as the dash 4, except it requires the sponsoring city and county to approve the special district opt-out.
All right. And who's the... Anyone who wants to testify?
You can ask if there's anyone who wants to testify. This is a work session, so we don't have a sign-up sheet.
No sign-up sheet. So is there anyone like to testify on 3143? Okay.
This is Mr.
Fisselman.
Okay.
Yes, Jack Isselman.
Yes.
Welcome.
Yeah. Chairman, members of the committee, Jack Isselman here on behalf of Jack Roberts and the Lane Metro Partnership. This committee kindly granted us the opportunity to testify on behalf of this bill when it was first heard in committee, I think approximately a month ago. In that time, I know the bill has been heard at least one other time in Eugene, and we, the Lane Metro Partnership, have been working together with the cities and counties to really find a bill that hopefully we can move out of this committee on to the Revenue Committee and continue through the legislative process. We appreciated the dialogue we had with this committee upon the introduction of this bill. Around some of the requirements for enterprise zones. In our judgment, we felt the best approach to move this legislation forward, and the most critical need of Lane County, and particularly the city of Eugene, was to get a new enterprise zone in place and not put Lane County and Eugene in a position where they're competing with sister communities in Oregon. Therefore, we support the approach that's evidenced in really all the amendments 2 through 5 that pares this down, adds an additional 10 to 15 enterprise zones. I know there's representatives of both the cities and the counties and the special districts here today, and there's some language in the bill that relates to concerns that they may have. For the purposes of the Lane Metro Partnership, and I believe the city of Eugene, we're not taking a position on any opt-out provisions that may be articulated in the bill, but we do think it's important that a bill move out of this committee soon that would increase the number of enterprise zones. As we've articulated before this committee previously, we think the demand is there. We know we can attract some robust projects to Lane County and to Eugene if we're able to restore the enterprise zone that was there into the late 90s. And so I would encourage you to move 3143 out of committee today with a due pass recommendation to revenue. Thank you.
If not, and so you are on neutral on dash, the dash 4, dash 5 amendment.
Yeah, we only need one enterprise zone, so we'll take 10 or 15.
Right? Thank you very
thank
much.
Thank you, Chairman.
Okay.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I move that we append the Dash 5 amendment to this bill.
Right. And before we move that, could we invite the... who should I invite?
I invite Ms. Squires.
Ms. Squires.
Ms. Squires.
Oh, Mrs. Squires?
Yeah.
Ms. Squires.
Ms. Okay. Thank you. Please give us some light. What is your position on Dash 4 and Dash 5, and what's the differences and your justification for certain amendment?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Hasina Squires here today on behalf of the Special Districts Association of Oregon. Just to give the committee a little bit of background on the enterprise zone issue for special districts, we do not have the authority to create or form enterprise zones, nor do we want that authority. We are merely subject to the provisions that take place when a city or county creates an enterprise zone. Our property taxes are preempted based upon the creation of the zone. We have no issue with the 49 zones that are currently in statute, and we're not seeking any opt-out type of provisions for those zones. But our policy and position from the association is, with the creation and proliferation of any new type of tax abatement zone, vertical housing zone, which passed in 2001 legislative session, and with the creation of 10, 20, 50, doesn't matter how many zones, one zone for Jack if he must have it for Eugene. As long as we have a provision in the statute that allows our ORS 198 taxing districts, water, sewer, fire, irrigation, ports, parks and recreation, the ability to opt out of those enterprise zones, we think is a policy matter that is actually pretty important to our districts because most of them are property tax funded, and so when a city or county creates an enterprise zone, it can have a significant impact on a rural fire protection district. So we support the Dash 4 amendments to that effect. The Dash 5 amendment, the only difference in between 4 and 5 is language on page... Page 2 of the Dash 5 amendments includes language that says the election of a local taxing district not to participate in an enterprise zone is effective only if the city or county seeking designation agrees with that opt-out. That sort of seems to negate the purpose of even having the opt-out, so we wouldn't understand why that would be in there. I will point out, though, in our zone, in this language, that the decision to opt out is an affirmative one that must be made on the special district's part. It is not a situation where you're automatically exempted. There has to be some action taken by the governing body of the special district to notify within 60 days that they do want to be let out of the zone. So it's not a blanket. Everyone's out unless they ask to be in. They're all out they can get out, but they have to make a decision, have a discussion, present a resolution, and be very clear with the zone sponsor on that. And we're supportive of that mechanism versus the everyone's out unless they opt in to the zone. So
Okay. Hopefully
that provides some clarity.
Any questions? Vice Chair Moakley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Are school districts included in the special district language that is involved?
Mr. Chair, Representative Merkley, no. School districts are not listed in ORS 198.
So just to clarify my understanding then, a water district under this could seek an opt-out, but a school district could not?
Mr. Chair, Representative Merkley, that is correct.
Can you explain the thinking behind that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Merkley, the school districts have never expressed to any of us any interest in having opt-out language in any type of property tax abatement legislation, to the best of my knowledge, for the past three legislative sessions.
Thank you.
All right. Any questions? Representative Buckley.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This question is, again, for my education. Should a special district opt out, what would be the impact of a company coming in to an enterprise zone? They would still pay that portion of their property taxes that would go towards the service provided by the special district. Do I have that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Buckley, that's exactly correct. I think one of the things to point out that I'd like to add to that is there's clarity in advance notice to the zone sponsor that that portion of the property tax will not be exempt. It's not something that occurs after the zone is designated and everyone knows up front that what the dollar amount will be for the abatement, yes.
Great. Thank you very much.
Okay. Art, you'd like to make some comment? We're going to come on in. Please hold over. We might have some additional questions. Please stay there.
Please share it with your knowledge.
Talk about fear. Thank you. Members of the committee, Chair Lim, for the record, my name is Arthur Fish with the Oregon Economic and Community Development Department. I appreciate the opportunity to be up here just to perhaps provide a little background on how ability for a special service district to elect out of an enterprise zone might work and some of the effects that we see and frankly, some of the concerns that, you know, it does raise in our eyes. With respect, and I should note, though, that we worked very hard over the last several years since the last time some enterprise zones were added to the mix. It was originally 37 or so, 10 were added in 1999. Since then, we make very sure that any time there's a proposal to create a zone or to extend a boundary or create a rural renewable energy zone or anything of that nature, that there is notice sent to all special or all taxing districts in general, including education districts. It doesn't give them any material right to actually change things, as an opt-out does, but it does provide for that local dialogue and input that, you know, it's been, I think, very productive. And generally speaking, the written comments we've seen that are sent to the local governments often tend to be very positive about doing the enterprise zone change. That said, if you have an opt-out, then yes, you do create a situation for these potential additional zones. And the department is supportive of the idea of having a few more zones to meet the demand of a Eugene or a Madras or a Forest Grove or whomever might want an enterprise zone in the future. But if you do an opt-out, you do create a situation where those particular zones have, you know, a somewhat potentially difficult distinction. Now, some local districts may or may not choose to use the opt-out. It may or may not have much of a dollar effect. If you go to a rural area and a fire district has opted out in that enterprise zone, yes, it could take a big chunk out of the tax benefit for businesses to locate there. Chances are, though, we're looking at, you know, maybe a cemetery district or a vector district, people with very small property tax rates. So, you know, the dollar effect may be somewhat minor. It's really what you have to bear in mind is some complexity that comes into this. It's very difficult, for the assessors. I can tell you some of the things that have happened with vertical housing development zones, where we've had opt-outs, and districts would like to reverse that, or it's been just such an infinitesimal amount of tax dollars involved that it's kind of just created a lot of confusion and so forth. With enterprise zones, we often hear about how complex things are and whatever, and it is sometimes complex, sometimes rather simple. But this would be a fairly complex issue to try to explain to people with respect to the fact that, well, in 49 zones you get 100% exemption. In a couple zones, you know, depending upon what happens, it's going to be something less or something of that nature. So I guess our only concerns are really, one, the complexity and some of the confusion that may happen with respect to it, and two, just the marketing message about enterprise zones and especially the ones that might have this opt-out if it took place and that sort of thing. So that's just some of the insights I'd like to share with the committee. Thank you.
Okay. You have a question?
Yes, please, Mr. Chair. Thank you. And then I don't know if there is such a thing as a known average across the state, but when the average citizen pays their county taxes, does 10% go to special districts? Does 20% go to special districts, and then the balance to the county? Or special districts comprise kind of what piece of the pie?
Basically, there is an average property tax rate around the state. It's about 12%. The maximum, of course, as you know, is 1.5%, or $15 per thousand. The number of enterprise zones in other places can get as high as $18, $19, depending upon special levies and so forth. You know, if you look at it, though, the education districts are $5. Local governments, county, city are going to be, you know, a bigger chunk. Special districts, and I'm sure Ascena has more specific data, will tend to be a fairly small piece, fire districts and others being the only ones that tend to have significant millage, as it's called. So they might represent just a couple dollars per thousand at most.
Mr. Chair, Representative Merkley, Art is correct. In some areas, though, you know, a fire district will have a pretty high property tax levy rate, but in general, the bulk of the $10, what's coming under the $10 cap is county, then city, and then probably rural fire protection district.
Thank you.
Okay. Representative Dellum?
Yes, and the cap is 10 mils, $10 per thousand. And the school is 5, and the government, I believe, is 3, city, county government.
Representative Dowell, members of the committee, $10 per thousand maximum applies to the regular operating levy of all other taxing districts other than education. So all the special districts plus the city county combined can't have an operating district operating levy that in effect taxes any property at more than $10 per thousand. The school district, it's $5 per thousand, but in effect a lot of total levies are even greater than $15 or 1.5% because of the additional of special levies and bonds and that sort of thing and urban renewal and so forth. So it gets pretty high in some cases.
Let's not talk about urban renewal.
Okay. Agreed.
All right.
One more question.
Yes.
I'm a little clouded in my own thinking. If we created an urban growth district and we had a bond issue for building, we'll say, a new school, the opt-out provision is not provided, so the new coming business would or would not have to pay the school building levy, not the operating levy, but the building levy.
Representative Dowell, members of the committee, if you have an enterprise zone with or without any type of opt-out, then a business that invests there, the exemption would apply to the taxes that would be due from that special bond levy or special operating levy. The only thing that might still, you know, be sort of exempt or excluded, shall I say, from the exemption in the case of a district that has elected not to participate in a particular new enterprise zone in the future would be their, you know, dollar per thousand, or in some cases 5 cents per thousand in the case of some of these cemetery districts and so forth that have just minimal 4-H districts, vector districts, a lot of them, and you know, Ascena knows her membership far better than I, have a variety of millages, and these are the types of districts that could, and from what I've seen with vertical housing development zones, not many of them really are interested. Now, an enterprise zone is a whole different beast than some of these other exemptions out there, but so I can't necessarily predict what these local areas, especially in rural areas, might do. But it would only be really respective to the operating levy of those types of special service districts, as they were called. So the school districts in any variety of other special levies, city or as well as city or county tax rates, would not be subject to any potential opt-out. So that property, that property taxes would be exempted, and then of course after the 3 to 5 year period, the company would pay all of those operating levies and other things as part of their tax bill. Does that help?
Very much. Thank you. Mr. Chairman, one more question.
Yes, one more question.
Thank you, Rich. We presently have 47 zones, and all zones are used?
Yes, 47 is the number in the law, and that is they are all designated. There are two more that exist by virtue of kind of very special laws that have been around. One is the ability for any federal enterprise zone, and there used to be a federal enterprise community in Josephine County. So this huge chunk of Josephine County is also a state enterprise zone. And then there's also the potential for reservation enterprise zones, and we got one of those. So 2 plus 47 gets us to the number 49, which you heard Tosina rightly correct. And they are all used up. And so we do have zones that become available on a regular 10-year cycle. As zones expire, then those areas need to reapply, and other areas may apply to get that up, that available designation. And so we're in the midst of doing that yearly now.
If I could pursue that, Vice Chairman.
Yes.
For example, in my district, I believe Madras expires very soon. The Dalles will expire a year, 18 months, something like that. They would then be applying for a new district, or would they just be applying for continuation of their present enterprise district?
Representative Dowell, members of the committee, what the law does is say, you know, this is a, you know, when a zone terminates, a zone can be designated to replace it. And it allows certainly for the area that had the zone to apply, and we can call it a redesignation by all means. But other areas could potentially apply as well. For example, last year, the Silverton Zone and the Roberts Creek or Roseburg Enterprise Zone both terminated. Silverton did not reapply. But somebody else did apply, and we had only two applicants, and that second one was Hermiston, and they created a new Hermiston Enterprise Zone with that. So, you know, they really are, in a sense, a new designation of an enterprise zone, but it does replace the one, and oftentimes they're really, the old ones are just redesignated in effect.
A lot of times. Most of the time it's a redesignation? Or
yeah, I would say over the past, you know, we've been doing redesignations or designations of recyclings, if you will, since 1996, and I would say probably nine or so of some 30-some zones have chosen not to apply. And so we've created some new zones in the time, but I would say, yeah, the majority are zones that come back and they basically get a new enterprise zone, and we call it zone two for them.
Thank you very much.
Yes.
Any other questions of the speakers? Thank you, Sina. Thank you, Art. Appreciate it. Okay, continue the discussion on 3143. Representative Riley?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I would like to withdraw the motion that I made earlier and move the dash 4 amendment to this bill.
Representative Riley has moved the dash 4 amendment to this bill. Any discussion? Representative Buckley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Riley, when thinking about this, I'm trying to think of the opt-out and what's the most democratic process here. Local officials would be accountable for decisions they made under the Dash 5 amendment that would say, you know, if they decided that, well, we're going to go for the enterprise zone, special district says it wants to opt-out, the city council or the county commissioner say, no, we really want this and we think it's worth it. If they damage the service that was provided by that special district, they would be accountable to the voters. I'm just trying to think this through. Whereas the special districts having the option to opt out would basically put the decision-making power within the special district in terms of the enterprise zone. And at least in my experience as a citizen, I don't have a lot of interaction with the special districts.
Yeah, we're showing that.
Absolutely.
Representative Buckley, we had this discussion in my by the committee, in regards to the vertical zones. And one of the things that we talked was brought out was Oregon City, where they had one of these zones, and the fact that the opt-out existed for that created a discussion between the requester, which was Oregon City for the zone, and the special districts, and actually every special district opted in after that discussion, but it did facilitate that discussion to happen. Whereas if the city had a veto, they wouldn't need to have this discussion, and I think the discussion is healthy.
Appreciate that. Any other discussion?
I would just like to make the point that before we move on, Chair Lim whispered to me, but for public record, that he is in most favorable support, if you will, of the Dash 2 amendment. However, he is open to the Dash 4. His issue is creating the confusion with the opt-out for the special districts. He likes 4 more than he likes 5 if we're going to do that. And I would just like to have the discussion, or at least make the point that this bill has gone through a lot of iterations to get to where it is now. It was infinite enterprise zones a month ago, so we're down to 10 now, it looks like. And basically, it's only these 10 new zones that would have this opt-out provision. So it really does give us, if nothing else, gives us 2 years to see if the opt-out provision for these 10 zones is workable or not. Mm-hmm. And then I think we'd have all due course in the 2007 legislative session to change or not as the case may justify. So that would be my voice in support of the Dash 4 amendment.
Vice Chair Boone, if I may, a question to you. I'm going through this now, and I want to be absolutely certain. The 47, actually 49 zones, but the 47 created by our legislation will remain exactly the same.
That's correct.
We're going to add 10 new zones.
We went from infinite to 10.
But the requirements for the zones remain exactly the same unless we do the Amendment 4, which would give other agencies an opportunity at least to be heard and the discussion would be held. So new zones would have us, so we really have 47 in one category, 2 in one category, and 10 that we would see how that worked for 2 years.
Correct. An additional 10, once again, the only difference would be the opt-out ability of the special districts. But yes, the way you stated is how I understand it.
And that's with 2 and 4.
It's with 4.
4 only.
4 is identical to 2 with the addition of the opt-out. So it would be redundant. If we're going to do 4, it would be redundant to do 2 as well. We could do 2 and not 4. But there is a motion on the table, so any more discussion?
No more discussion.
And Representative Riley's motion, which is to adopt the Dash 4. Okay. Any opposition to adopting the Dash 4? Okay. So ordered. Okay. Let's any more discussion on House Bill 3143? Okay. I'm willing to entertain a motion. Representative Merkley.
Mr. Chair, I believe it's in order, but I want to check this before I make the motion that we are sending this to the Revenue Committee.
That's correct.
So I move that HB 3143 be sent to Revenue Committee as amended with a due pass recommendation.
May I interrupt? Actually, this does not go to Revenue.
Oh.
That again.
What?
This does not show any subsequent referral to Revenue. What we could do is... Anyway, I haven't spoken. According to your House rules, we would need to get the permission of the Speaker. What we could do is modify any motion that you wish to make so that if we do get that permission, we can refer it to Revenue.
Mr. Chair.
Yeah, Representative Merkley.
I'm going to repeat the motion. And put a contingent clause on it, I guess. I'm not quite sure. I've never seen that. Because I'm not sure what happens if permission is not granted, then would it go straight to the floor?
It would go to the floor.
Okay. Does it make sense for us to move this or to seek that permission first and move this in our next committee meeting?
Representative Merkley, I guess I would ask the question of you, if the Speaker did not grant that authority, are you uncomfortable with this going? I mean, that's the question. Uncomfortable with this going straight to the floor? And if so, if you have great enough reservations, then maybe we do have to seek that permission ahead of time.
I think I'm uncomfortable with that. I'm looking around to see if anyone else wants to comment before I proceed.
I guess my question would be, the purpose of having sent to revenue would be just to make sure what the fiscal impact would be. Is that what your concern is, Representative?
Well, yes, it's a long-standing tradition that any revenue bills go through revenue. I'm expecting the chair of revenue to have something to say about this issue. And you make a good point, Representative Buckley, in regards to the revenue impact statement. However, I'm still comfortable if the Speaker wants to send this directly to the floor, that'd be fine. But anyone else have strong feelings about this?
Excuse me. Yeah, I actually, it does have revenue impact, there's no question. And as you say, there is tradition, I'm sure Chair Butler in the Revenue Committee does have some things to say about this. I guess I would accept the motion to send it to either the floor or revenue, depending on the Speaker's motion, but I would like to strongly seek that permission.
I'd like to suggest that, and this is a little unusual to be conversing on this without the actual amendment, but it's an unusual situation. Perhaps we move it to Revenue Committee seeking the permission of the Speaker, and if that is not granted, that we pick this up for reconsideration here in the committee and decide whether to send it directly to the floor. That way we can look at the revenue impact statement and think about that piece of it.
Okay.
So I'll make that motion then, Mr. Chair. I move that we send this bill as amended to the Revenue Committee with a due pass recommendation on the contingency we get permission of the Speaker to so refer it, and that if we do not get that permission, that the bill remains here in committee for us to take another look at.
Representative Dell.
Yes, now let me be sure that I understand this. We're going to send this to Revenue. And if the Speaker gives us permission to bypass revenue, then we're going to revisit this bill? And is that what the amendment says?
Not how I understand it. Would you like to restate?
Yes, I'd like to clarify that. If the Speaker grants permission, it would go to revenue. If the Speaker does not grant permission, we would reconsider it here in committee and decide whether we want to send it directly to the floor.
So we're asking the Speaker to send it to revenue?
We're asking, yes, for her to grant our motion to send it to revenue.
I'm worried about the health and welfare of the bill. Is there a revenue impact on taxes that have never been levied?
That's a good question.
There's a revenue impact on the potential.
We're not talking about tax. We're talking about taxes that have never been levied. And if we're going to attract business to a community, we're asking for a revenue impact on a bill that is designed to give revenue or to attract business by abating their tax structure. When we send this to revenue, we're doing exactly the opposite of what the bill wants to do. The reason for the bill is to attract business with a tax enhancement.
I don't feel strongly about this. I'm just trying to honor normal protocol and not step on anyone's toes here in the process. I would be fine. Is the chair returning?
He is, but he was unsure when he was returning.
He may want to weigh in on this protocol. I'm happy to follow his lead and withdraw my almost stated motion.
That's good. So just to make sure I'm clear on what Representative Merkley is saying, it's more of a concern for protocol, it's more a concern for respect for the revenue chairman, that we don't push something past that he would not be aware of and feel like that we were slighting him in any way. So I would back, if there's any way we can, wait for the guidance of our chair, since he will have to deal on the peer-to-peer basis on that.
So why don't we, Mr. Administrator, why don't we temporarily close the work session on 3143? Can we do that?
Sure.
And move into the next one? Okay. I'd like to...
I think if I'm the secretary, if I could ask one question, I may come along with Representative Berkeley's mate. What did we do with the vertical revenue bill? Did we send that? It was a vertical housing. Did we send that to revenue?
Absolutely.
Yes. That's what we're... Okay.
Along with the e-commerce.
Then I'll withdraw my objections and we'll take your motion so we can get it out of here.
Yeah. The motion is off the floor, as I understand it, so I will temporarily close the work session on House Bill 3143, and I would like to open a work session on House Bill 3144.
Mr. Chair, this bill does have a subsequent referral to revenue. It allows corporations operating emerging businesses to defer corporate excise and personal income taxes. Provides the Department of Revenue with a lien against all real and personal property of the corporation for the duration of the deferment in the amount of the deferred tax. It limits the amount of tax deferred to $200,000 or 80% of the tax liability, whichever is less. You have a amendment, a -1 amendment, limits the tax deferral period to 2 years.
Thank you, Mr. Administrator. Is there any discussion on House Bill 3144? Representative Buckley.
Thank you, Mr. Vice Chair. I am wondering, one of the questions I had concerning this bill, which I think is a great idea, was whether we had any kind of estimate on the cash flow of the state. With this in place, how many companies might be available to take advantage of this, what impact that would have on the cash flow. I know over the long run it's actually beneficial, but whether we know how that cash flow would work.
I knew you were going to ask me that question because I specifically remember you asking me that question when I testified on this. My staff has been trying to find the number of how many businesses qualify, if you will, with the designation as written in here. And the problem that we have discovered is the same problem that I addressed briefly in my comments, which is that is not how governmental entities look at small business.
Right.
Governmental entities, in my opinion, incorrectly, or at least not fully correctly, look at small business in the define small business by employee size.
Right.
I think that's a measure, but it's certainly not it's not the measure as I address in my comments. It's not the measure that I'm used to, or I think it's the easiest or the best way to measure it. But so the long-winded answer to your question is I do not have a good answer to your question. Something that has come up, and I would throw this out for consideration to the committee, it is one of the questions. You know, how many companies are we looking at? Because I've only been able to provide anecdotal evidence. And what is the tax deal? What is the potential, not tax loss, of course, but tax deferral, and what is the near-term impact? And Chair Lim, in discussions about this bill, said that was his, he liked the idea as well, but that's, and I'm not trying to speak for him, he'll be back and he can speak to this, but in conversations with me, expressed that he was favorable to this bill, but because of the unknown with that, was open and suggesting that it include a 4-year sunset provision on as well, which is something that I would support. And this, as you know, this has to be subsequently referred to Revenue Committee. It's something, it's an amendment that could be adopted via the Revenue Committee, and I would be absolutely content with that if that addresses part of your question or part of your issue.
Sure. It does address part of the concern, and again, I'm concentrating on the immediate future and the needs that we're seeing right in front of us. I want to make sure that we're trying to address those with as many resources as possible. But again, I commend you on the bill. I think it's a very good idea, and I think it's very possible. So I would be in support, particularly with the sunset. I think that would be helpful.
Thank you. Any other discussion? Mr. Mistra, tell me how we can do this. What I'd like to do is a conceptual amendment. Or is it something that we just send over to revenue and then tell them they got to do this? Or ask them to do this?
The chair expressed the opinion that if you wanted to add a... If the conceptual you're talking about is to add a sunset onto it, he would be content with sending that to the revenue committee to have them do that, understanding the time constraints that there are on the bill.
Okay. Any discussion on that? Okay. I would be willing to entertain a motion or not. We're short staffed.
Mr. Vice Chair, I would move that House Bill 3144 be sent to the Revenue Committee with a due pass recommendation.
You have an amendment that you may want to deal with.
I'm sorry.
The dash one.
I'm sorry.
You don't need to put that on. Revenue can consider that also.
Let me do that. I'm sorry. That's my glaring mistake. Although I don't have a copy right here. The original intent of this bill, there we go. The original intent of this bill, if I may, was for a 2-year tax deferral and a 4-year repayment. That was the language that was submitted to LC, Legislative Council, but that's not the way the original bill came back. The original bill came back 4-year deferral and a 4-year repayment, which was never the idea. So the amendment goes back to the original intent, which is a 2-year tax deferral and a 4-year tax repayment.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I'd like to withdraw my previous motion. I'd like to move the Dash 1 amendment be approved to House Bill 3144.
Okay. Any discussion? Any opposition?
Chair, I'd like to move the House Bill 3144 as amended be passed on to the Revenue Committee with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Buckley has moved that we move House Bill 3144 as amended to the House Revenue Committee with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? And would you call the roll?
Representative Buckley.
Aye.
Representative Dallin.
Aye.
Representative Merkley.
Excuse.
Representative Nelson.
Excuse.
Representative Riley.
Aye.
Vice Chair Bruin.
Aye.
Chair Lim.
Excused. It passes 4-0.
How do I say that technically? Mr. Vice Chair, this House Bill 3144 will be on its way to revenue with the Dash 1 amendment.
Okay. Thank you. Any other... We'll close the work session on 3144. We see that the chair is not here. He did say he would be back. We could stand at ease for a few minutes, and I'll take a sense of the committee, whether or not they're dying to get out here. I would suggest standing at ease for maybe 5 minutes, at least giving him the opportunity to get back in here so we can move this bill. Understanding the time constraints with that. Oh. And there you have it.
I'll wait 2 minutes and not a minute.
Or not even 5 minutes.
I'm not going to wait at all.
Good job of vamping, Scott.
Mr. Chairman, as your staff, the other members can correct me. We were waiting on your return on House Bill 3143. The committee has adopted the Dash 4 amendment. And realize now that the bill does not have a subsequent referral to revenue, which they had thought it did.
It didn't have a referral?
No, and I must apologize for not being out ahead on this one. And we have no... The House rules require the permission of the Speaker to change the referral, and we have no message from the Speaker. We've not asked the Speaker what the Speaker's preference would be on this... this bill, whether this bill would go to revenue or not. So the committee was in a little bit of a dilemma. Staff suggested kind of a bifurcated motion whereby if we got the speaker's permission, we would go ahead and show it as having been moved to the revenue committee. but then they weren't sure what would happen if the speaker decided not to. So that's where we were.
Okay.
Mr.
Chair.
Okay.
Yes. Sure. I was right before you walked up. I was handed given a note, which I think is a good idea if we can do this.
Did we open a work session? Did we reopen the work session on this?
Let me do it. Yeah. Like to reopen the work session on House Bills 3143. This suggests that maybe staff give the Speaker's office a call right now before we adjourn to see if they're have a thought on this and or not.
I think we should have a written. Yeah.
Sure, we have to have a written approval, but.
What was the point out of a 5 we adopted dash 4?
We adopted dash 4.
We adopted dash 4.
Yeah.
What's the justification, the dash 4 instead of 1, 2, 3, 5?
Justification was that there was, first of all, that you know, a couple points. First of all, was agreeing that maybe 10, you know, we went as was discussed, went from infinite down to 10,
okay.
The new enterprise zones. The other discussion was there was discussion both in favor of an opt-out and in sort of not necessarily disfavor, but sort of saying that there could be some complexity problems with having the opt-out provision put in there. Some of the discussion up here revolved around the fact that since the additional 10 enterprise zones which the amendment would adopt are the only 10 enterprise zones that are subject to the opt-out criteria. So it does not affect the other 49 existing enterprise zones. It would only affect the additional 10 that we're creating with this bill. That given that, it would at least give us some time in the next 2 years to see if that opt-out provision was workable or not, and we could come back at that point and have an answer to it.
We might take their teeth out by opting out. How many special districts do we have? About there, what, 10 of them?
There was no sense of that.
I don't know.
Each district, what happens opt out then?
Some of the discussion was, and that was part of the discussion, if I may, Mr. Chair, that came up. But I would say the lion's share of the discussion on special districts was that, for the most part, it was from a dollar and cents perspective, was a fairly minor component in the overall property tax scheme of things. I don't want to oversimplify that. And, of course, every geographic area will have a difference. But as taxing authorities go, as a percentage of overall property taxes that we're looking at abating with the enterprise zone, the sense from the testimony was that special districts are usually either small or a very small portion of the overall.
Very small.
Yeah.
If I may add,
we don't know how small it is.
If I may add, Mr.
That'd be different every place.
Mr. Chair, we do have some experience with opt-out in the vertical housing zones, and that's been workable.
Okay. That's been workable.
Hi, Bruce.
Okay.
We're in hearing here in work session on House Bill 3143. It has to do with enterprise zones.
Okay. Art, this is can I call you again, if I may? Yes, thank you.
All the restrictions off enterprise zones. We want to just keep all the restrictions on enterprise zones.
Thank you, Chair Lim, members of the committee. Again, Arthur Fish with Economic Community Development. Happy to answer your questions. I was up here before.
When it's opt-out, how is it going to complicate the current enterprise zone system?
Well, as I mentioned to the committee before, it is a complication. It's something that, you know, if the dollars and cents, you know, can vary from tax code to tax code, and you asked how many districts there are, you know, you have an enterprise zone, potentially, you know, several tax codes, maybe dozens of tax codes with various taxing districts that overlap. One tax code may have a city, county, and one or two districts. Another, depending upon part of the state, there may be, you know, there may be as many as 10 or 15 special districts. That's the edge. And Messina can correct me if it never gets that high, but there are some counties where it gets very high in certain tax codes. And if you had some opt-outs, as I explained to the committee, it's, you know, the dollars and cents may be fairly modest in most, in many cases, even if any districts do opt out. But if some do, then we do have this situation where you have some zones that are in this category with an opt-out or so, and you kind of have to explain to the business how, well, you know, if you're in this tax code, it might be a 97% exemption. In this tax code, it might still be 100% because that district doesn't even exist in that tax code in the enterprise zone. And so you do get into all these complexities and confusions. And I guess what makes enterprise zones different in this respect, maybe from other exemptions, is that we're dealing with businesses that, you know, they'll work through some of the, you know, the procedures and complexities, but, you know, we try to keep the message simple. And this could be somewhat of a burden for the system as a whole, but especially for those zones that might, you know, not be able to. And again, I do want to, agree with Representative Riley strongly that it is a great way to get dialogue at the local level. And that's why with enterprise zones, we put extraordinary emphasis on that happening, even if there isn't a material way for the districts to really get out. And I think, you know, and what's happened with vertical housing zones is, over time, there was a few districts when this first started that used it. I think the Klamath County one, but like in Milwaukee or Clackamas County that Representative Riley referred to, and Eugene, they just went out and they talked to all the districts and got them very much on board, and so none of them really felt they had to opt out. And but, you know, then we've got LeGrand, where a cemetery district opted out and now wants to reverse that. And they can't really do that. And then, you know, there's a situation in Grants Pass where the assessor just wanted to give the district $20 to, you know, not bother with this because it was coming down to like 40 cents was going to be the effect. So it gets kind of confusing and strange. And I just, you know, with the enterprise zones, you know, we as I expressed, we are concerned about, you know, confusing the issue and creating some complexity and mixed marketing messages that, you know, about how, you know, you're welcome, but, you know, there was this district in this one zone in this one area that opted out, and so hence, you know, and you can sort of see how awkward that could get sometimes. Mm-hmm. So that's our only concern. But in reality, we're only talking about a few zones that this might apply to, for better or worse, and we're only talking about potentially a few cents on the dollar, relatively speaking. And again, if people get out and do what we insist they do anyway under the current procedures.
My concern is not necessarily a sense of dollars, but it's just a procedure.
Yeah, that's my concern.
I'm concerned.
Chairman,
I don't want to make it more complicated.
Yeah.
In the past, is there any problem that any district, special district, wants to opt out and then prevented it? Did we have any problem in the future, in the past?
Representative Lim, members of the committee, yes, we share, the department shares those concerns, and we are, you know, we, you know, would ask this issue to get due consideration. In the past, there, you know, like I say, we insist that zones seeking designation or boundary change do reach out with a written notice 21 days before a resolution is passed for, comment from the special districts. And I have not heard of any districts that in that phase felt, you know, in any way less than support. Probably most of them are rather neutral, or maybe they would like to opt out and they just don't say anything because it's pointless maybe. But I have in many of these boundary changes and designations received letters from fire districts, port districts, hospital districts, and the rest that saying, you know, they're really for this because they want economic development in their area. They want that increase in the tax base down the road, and they just want to lend their support. So I have not heard, to answer your question, the word is no, but I can't provide that no with the absolute certainty that there isn't some unheard party out there that, you know, would have taken an opt-out if they could have.
So as you read this bill with the amendment, and that the new zones, this is strictly apply to the 10 zones, or this will apply the whole, according to the
language written in this bill.
Chair Lim,
I don't see any clear in that.
Well, Chair Lim, members of the committee, I would agree with the Senate, and I do believe it is clear that this opt-out would only apply to those zones that are to be designated under that referred paragraph or subsection of the law. And in fact, really, it would only apply the first time they're designated. 10 years down the road, when they're redesignated, they wouldn't. I don't see any, because I wouldn't see that there would be an opt out there, because it's an entirely different statute that provides for that recycling of zones afterwards. So it's only the initial designation of those potential first 10, as it's designated, as it's envisioned in the law now, that would be potentially affected by an opt-out in the event that, you know, certain districts in the, with those particular designations chose to do that. So I do believe it is satisfactorily clear. The question is, do you want to go down that path at all, even with these few zones? Or, well, 10 is not few. I mean, 10 is a good number, but and I don't know how many of those 10 would be designated right away. I don't have that many out there that are seeking zones, so there may only be a few. If you came back 2 years from now, there may only be one or two of these zones that we'd actually find takers for. Demand is pretty well satisfied, I think, statewide.
So do you believe the you can work with that this best for amendment, or what is your suggestion and recommendations, even though we heard that will complicate?
Chair Lim, members of the committee, you know, we can work with anything. You know, that's our job. but it is new ground, so I can't really say exactly how well it would work. I could tell you it will be a, you know, we would probably urge zones to work with their districts and convince them not to take it, because we would say, look, this is going to make your marketing message harder and more difficult if you have this. Just dollars, as you point out correctly, dollars and cents aside, it is something that, you know, businesses, they don't want to hear about all these sorts of nuances and so forth. I mean, you know, it is hard enough just to make sure they do the paperwork right and everything, and they do a great job, but, you know, this is another issue. So I would say, yeah, I mean, we could, I can see it working. I look at the prospect of it with a lot of concern. With working with county assessors to, because they have to create a whole new tax code in effect when you have one of these opt-outs, and it is something that I know the Department of Revenue, which isn't here today, has expressed concern about these opt-outs in other areas because of the you know, it is so complex. I wish there was just an easier way to maybe just rebate or refund money to the districts in lieu of creating these opt-outs, which is a much more technically challenging perspective. And so I would say the department, if we had our druthers, would definitely support more of a -2 approach, which is just a clean, maybe even a smaller number of a designation, so that it's less offensive to other parties, if that was possible. And instead of 10, maybe 5 or 3, or, well, 5 or 6 or whatever, and we'll just go with that. And but, you know, that's, you know, we want to express our concerns and not be seen as dictating to the committee.
Representative Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wanted to ask a question about your marketing that you're talking about. You say it complicates the message. Is it your practice to, when you're trying to attract businesses, to tell them what they're not getting as opposed to telling them what they are getting? I think that we need our marketing message that says, here are the tax breaks you're getting, and not the message that says, oh, you're getting tax breaks except from this. I don't think that's a good message.
Well, Chair Lim, Representative Riley, members of the committee, obviously at a certain level, we wouldn't burden our message with these sorts of details, especially when they might apply in such few areas, in such few instances. You're absolutely correct. We do, however, you know, our message with enterprise zones, one of the simplest, strongest messages we can say is, look, it's 100% exemption from property taxes on your new property. Now, there's some details there that, you know, we make sure we get to, because we don't want to mislead people as well. And so it's really at that next level when you're talking with businesses, and it really comes in two pieces. The big companies that may want to locate or do something massive, you know, those dollars and cents can add up, and so we really have to make sure. And with the small businesses that, you know, are just sort of using the zone and expanding and doing stuff, again, it's really a matter of where they're located, and we just want to make sure that they understand when that tax bill comes that there's still that money on there that maybe they didn't think they'd have to pay. And so there is, in a sense, your question kind of alludes to the fact that, you know, at one point, yeah, we don't really want to bother, but at the other hand, you know, it puts us in a position where down the road we have to say, oh, and I forgot to mention that, you know, there's this little thing, no big deal, and we'll try to convince them of that to be sure, but we won't sugarcoat it beyond what we can.
All right. No more questions? Okay. As the chair, I'm not quite convinced that the Dash 4 is the best thing. And I want to talk with you and then also the counties, discuss, find out some good solutions on this matter. And then I want to bring this bill back on Monday. I want to move out this bill. This is a very important bill. So let's find out some solutions, possibly maybe out of 10, maybe 5 could be without the opt-out, maybe 5 for opt-out or something. I don't know, my just instant suggestion. I want to find out some reasonable ground to work with, and then certainly I will bring this bill back on Monday.
Chair, members of the committee, I will take that message directly to our director, and of course you must include the special districts in this discussion at some level. So,
okay.
That's coming from them, and we definitely are very sensitive to concerns and have worked very strong with districts and local areas to, you know, make sure they're as comfortable as can be with enterprise zone type exemptions.
Okay. Thank you very much. All right. With that, I'd like to close the House bill. This is 3143, right?
Correct.
3143. The Vice Chair Broome, do you want to go ahead with the bill now,
sure,
or you want to look at it on Monday?
We did. Would you like to vote on it?
We did.
You did it?
Oh. I'd like to reopen the work session and vote on it.
Which one was it? 3144.
Right? Yeah.
We have 3144. We're showing.
What was that one?
This is one that would allow corporations offering emerging businesses to defer excise and personal income taxes.
Yes, of course. Did you have to put the sunset in it?
We discussed that, and that will be when it has been referred to revenue with the understanding they'll put a 4-year sunset in it.
Yes. Yeah. Okay. I'd like to vote on it on that.
Open the work session.
I'd like to open our work session. Our House bill is 3144. How do you want me to say?
Just express your vote. How would you vote?
I want to vote aye.
All right.
Okay. So, close the work session on House Bill 3144, and I want to also close the work session 3143. And since there's no other business, our meeting is adjourned. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yeah.